Hi, everybody. Welcome along to another episode of the Dispatches Podcast. My name is Brendan Malone. It is great to be back with you again. And today's topic of conversation, why the Christian sexual vision is the best for human flourishing. Hi, my name is Brendan Malone, and you're listening to The Dispatches, the podcast that strives to cut through all the noise in order to challenge the popular narratives of the day with some good old-fashioned contrarian thinking. You might not always agree, but at least you'll be taking a deeper look at the world around you. Don't forget, if you're new here, folks, please hit subscribe. If you've been a subscriber for a while and you're enjoying the content and you can do this on whatever platform you're listening on, please give us some stars and a like. All of that really, really helps the show. And last but not least, don't forget, if you are not following my new Substack, The Dispatches at Substack, I will post a link for that in the show notes for this episode. Please do that. We've got some exclusive content now that is regularly appearing only on that particular platform, so please go and do that. You can also become a paid subscriber there if you want to. That's all very new. But if you want to support our podcast work in other ways, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. I'll put a link for that in today's show notes. A huge thank you to all of our patrons and subscribers on Substack. It's thanks to you that today's episode is made possible. So, why the Christian sexual vision is the best for human flourishing. And basically, this is an amended version of a presentation that I was recently asked to give to an open event at Auckland University. So, the way I would often start when engaging on this issue is by asking what I think is actually quite a fundamental and important question. I like to ask people to imagine their future when it comes to relationships and sex, and what kind of future happiness or what kind of future experience are they seeking. And to make this a little less R18, what I also like to do is tell them to imagine that when it comes to relationships and sex, we're actually talking about a house. And perhaps they could imagine what kind of house do they want to be living in future if that house represents relationships and sexuality happiness. And the overwhelming majority of people will say to me that I want to be living in a nice, comfortable, welcoming house. That's what they want. No one says to me, I really hope that I'm living in some sort of rundown shack in the middle of Twizel with no power and there's rats running around all over the place and there's spiders in every corner and it's full of mold. I don't want any of that. I want a good future. And definitely no one says to me, Brendan, I really hope that when it comes to relationships and sexuality, my future house looks like a burning wreck that is collapsing down around my ears as I fall to my knees in the middle of all of the carnage, screaming, why God, where did it all go so wrong? We all want to experience happiness in our lives, and I think we all want to experience genuine relationship and romantic and sexual intimacy fulfillment. And I think that that is actually a good and important desire to have. It's a very, very important one. In fact, if we go right back to the start of the Christian and Jewish scriptures and we explore the book of Genesis, we see something very important that Christianity has to say about all of this. The first thing to note is that Adam is created and he experiences in that state of initial creation what Pope John Paul II called original solitude. So he was alone. He named all the other animals in the garden, but none of them he could really give himself to as friend. Something was incomplete here. Something wasn't what it should be. There was a piece of the puzzle that was still missing. And so he goes to God seeking answers. And God puts him to sleep, and from his side he creates, no, not the McRib, but woman. And the first thing to note about this creation is that Adam is asleep when this happens. So Eve, her first encounter, her first communion is not with man, her first communion is with God, just like Adam's was. So the two of them, they will meet eventually when Adam awakes as equals. And there's that beautiful poem, which I often paraphrase, about how Eve was created from the side of Adam, not from his head so that she would lord it over him, and not from his feet so that he would be lording it over her, but from his side, the two of them together, side by side on this profound communal journey. And this is what Pope John Paul II now refers to as original unity. There is a beautiful, deep, profound, and meaningful community between Adam and Eve, a communion that is profoundly good, that is substantial, that is meaningful, and that has profound implications for all of us as human persons. This is the pinnacle of creation in the Christian vision of reality. Creation is not Adam, and then as an afterthought, along comes woman. No, the pinnacle of creation is found in that communion between man and woman together. It is together, too, that they image God. Genesis tells us this in chapter 1. In the image of God, he made them male and female, he created them. So the first point I'd make to you is this. If you are someone who desires that genuine sexual happiness and flourishing when it comes to intimacy, romance, relationships, and the human sexual experience, then the Christian sexual vision of reality would tell you that sexual happiness, that path from original solitude to sexual flourishing, is found by saving sex for the lifelong commitment of a loving and monogamous marriage. And by the way, it's not just Christianity anymore that is pointing to the profound importance of this natural law truth. There is a growing awareness in our culture that something is not right with the hedonistic vision sold to us by the sexual revolution. We have authors like Mary Harrington, who wrote an excellent book called Feminism Against Progress. I highly recommend it. Authors like Louise Perry, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, another excellent read that I highly recommend. Both of these authors are people outside of Christianity, and yet they are seeing that there is something fundamentally good and true. There is a natural law truth for all human persons that is offered to the world by the Christian sexual vision of reality. There's also something else that's quite important here to understand, and that is the fact that the sexual revolution is not simply how we often tend to think of it today, a period where there were revolutionary new ideas about sex. No, it's actually much deeper and a lot worse than that. The original phrase, the sexual revolution, was coined by a man named Wilhelm Reich, and Wilhelm Reich was a very committed Marxist. And Wilhelm Reich, when he used that phrase, the sexual revolution, and some academics literally describe him as the midwife who helped to birth the sexual revolution in the 1960s and beyond. And one of the things that Wilhelm Reich was passionate about as a Marxist was he believed that the old bourgeois society needed to be torn down and replaced with a new and what he deemed to be better Marxist order. And what he believed was that sex needed to be used as a weapon in that Marxist revolution. So when he invents the phrase the sexual revolution, he doesn't mean revolutionary new ideas about sex. He means we must use sexual hedonism as a weapon, as a tool to tear down the old Christian order of chastity, of marriage, of family stability, etc., in order that we can remake society in our own new Marxist image. And so he understands something, quite perversely, obviously, but he understands something quite important and true here, that our Christian sexual vision is not simply about personal preferences. Our Christian sexual vision, absolutely, the way that we live this out, will absolutely be the making or the breaking of an entire society. If they get this wrong, it's not just about individuals experiencing unhappiness. It is absolutely about social confusion, collapse, chaos, and carnage. And I don't think we perhaps appreciate that as much as we should. We don't appreciate the communal dimension of the human experience and the way in which sexuality, as much as we might imagine it to be this way, this idea that we can just live it out in a very individualistic, siloed kind of way, that is not the reality of how societies actually work. And in actual fact, it is the ungluing of societies and at a very deep and profoundly destructive level. You see, what we've got going on in our society now is basically we've got a whole lot of people who are desperately trying to seek out and find that sexual and intimacy happiness in their lives, but they have been sold a faulty vision, a faulty idea or understanding about how that might be achieved. There's a really great song from folk artist David Wilcox, which I think really sums this up in a very clear, succinct and stark kind of way. It's called Language of the Heart. And this song, Language of the Heart, if there weren't copyright restrictions, I'd really love to play it to you now. But Language of the Heart is the song which starts out like a kind of typical, I guess, 70s, 80s type. Think of the Eagles, perhaps, maybe. One of those kind of songs that you think is just your typical enunciation, someone singing, expressing themselves musically about a one-night stand. And that's how it starts. This couple who sleep together in the desert, and it's all supposed to be hunky-dory. But in actual fact, it's not. And what happens is, as the song progresses, we discover that natural law has come into contact with ideology. So the ideology says, look, sex is just about preference. It's just about pleasure. If you want to make yourself happy by doing this thing, by sleeping with this person, having a one-night stand, why shouldn't you? Why should you be deprived of that? And so this couple do that, and then all of a sudden this ideology runs up against the cruel mistress of Mother Nature, of natural law. And natural law says, that's not how that works. And so by the end of this song, what we have is this artist who is singing things like, you can say that you were always honest and your words were clear from the start, but it's more than just words that got spoken. There was language of the heart. And what he means here is that our bodies were doing something that actually united us in a profound and meaningful kind of way. And to try and treat that as a trivial thing that you can just treat like entertainment or sport or something that you employ whenever you see fit for your own personal happiness is actually not realistic, because people do fall for each other. They are drawn together. There is something powerful at work here when two people engage in sexual activity. It carries great meaning and great weight. And can I suggest to you once again that the Christian sexual vision is the best and the most coherent road to sexual happiness for those who genuinely want that in their lives. Again, to repeat this, the path from original solitude to sexual flourishing is found by saving sex for the lifelong commitment of a loving, monogamous marriage. Here's what a 2015 survey of 3,800 adults from China called Sex and Happiness found. And let me quote to you now from that survey. Among our major findings are that having more frequent sex with a primary partner in the past 12 months is positively correlated with happiness. Similarly, having better quality sex reflected in higher emotional and physical satisfaction with one's primary partner is positively related to happiness. Consistent with Blanchflower and Oswald, which was a previous study in 2004, we find that the optimal number of sexual partners to maximize happiness in the previous 12 months is one, and that engaging in extramarital sex is negatively correlated with happiness. We also find that having unwanted sex or having sex simply to satisfy one's partner is associated with lower happiness. Or what about this survey from the State of Our Union survey in America in 2022? And they found that the percentage of survey respondents who were having sex the most often, as in with their spouse once a week or more often than that, were Christians who regularly attended religious services together. Those who occasionally attended religious services together were lagging behind them, but the lowest group of all were people who never or who really attend religious services together, or where both spouses in the relationship were non-religious. They also found that the percentage of survey respondents reporting being very happy, quote unquote, with their sexual relationship, the highest group for that particular outcome was those who regularly attend religious services together. Those who occasionally attend religious services together, in other words, they don't have as strong a commitment to their religious faith, they were lagging behind by about 30% behind the others. And those who never or rarely attend religious services together or are both non-religious, they were the lowest when it came to saying that they were very happy with their sexual relationship. So why would it be that there clearly seems to be this correlation going on with couples who take their Christian faith seriously? Why is it that they are experiencing better sex? Well, there's some good reasons that would obviously make sense of all of this. The first one, and this is very important, is there is reduced risk if you follow the Christian sexual vision of reality. So there's only one partner involved. They are monogamous. And that obviously is going to reduce things like the risk of heartbreak, the risk of jealousy and envy, the risk of sexual disease, the risk of psychological harms that can come from non-monogamous situations. So all of that risk is dramatically reduced. When you're having sex, you're not playing the lottery. Like, for example, if you look at sexual health websites today, the general trend in the Western world seems to be that you are advised, if you are sexually active, to be getting regular sexually transmitted infection checks every 6 months, or some websites say every 12 months. But 12 months is the highest that I've ever seen the recommendation go. So somewhere between 6 and 12 months. Every 6 to 12 months, you are supposed to be going and checking whether or not you have played and lost the sexual disease lottery because of your behavior. Why would anyone think that that is a better, safer, and more effective pathway to human flourishing? That does not make any sense at all. Because you know who doesn't actually need to go and get 6 monthly STI checks? My wife and I don't need to do that. People who are married to each other in a committed, monogamous marriage where they are not having sex with anyone outside of their partner, i.e. the Christian sexual vision of reality, those people are not actually carrying that same level of risk. They don't need to do that. It's just not even a thing for them. And then, of course, there are the psychological and emotional impacts that come when you are not in a stable relationship or when you have more than one partner in a relationship. As much as some people desperately want to try and paint multi-partner relationships, like they call them thruples now, or polygamy or bigamy, polyamory is another word that they want to try and euphemistically apply to these situations. As much as they would try and present that as being, in actual fact, a very manageable state of affairs, honest people and the actual evidence shows you that that is not the case at all. And why would it be? I think it's a complete denial of the fundamental reality of the human experience to think that you could maintain open multi-partner relationships and then not be problems that result. At the very least, things like jealousy and envy. If we could go back, of course, to David Wilcox in The Language of the Heart, he sums it up so perfectly. It's more than just words that get spoken. There was language of the heart. And so, of course, there are implications when two human beings engage in the most intimate act that two human beings or more can engage in. There are always going to be implications in this. And then, of course, there is a benefit to society as well, because we know that the most optimal situation for children to be raised in is a loving, stable family home with a mum and a dad present who love each other and bring peace into that home and then bring stability into the life of that child as well. And before they even think about good parenting techniques to show love and care for their child, which is also very important, the mere fact that mum and dad love each other and have stability in that relationship, that in and of itself transmits profoundly important benefits to the children. I still remember to this day an incident that I had. It must have been about 12 years ago from memory. I was driving all the way out of the city to another location to speak at a men's event. And on the way back, I picked up a hitchhiker. He was coming back into the city and we got talking. And he was French. He was here as a visitor. He was a working visitor and he was doing a bit of trekking around the place and working in a couple of tourist spots. And we got talking. And this was a man in his 20s. And we were talking and he asked me what I'd been up to. I explained where I'd just been and what I'd talked about. And then he started sharing more honestly about his family experience. And he told me, my parents just recently, so remember, this is a man in his mid-20s, my parents just recently divorced. So literally in the last year or so, his parents, their marriage ended in divorce. And as far as, I guess you'd call it the popular consensus that probably most people hold, is that yes, divorce is absolutely something that can be very destructive in the life of a young child. But if you're older, it's not the same thing because you're a bit more mature. And so I actually asked him about this. I asked him, how did he feel about this as an adult? And he said to me, it was truly devastating. He said it was the worst thing that had happened in his life so far. Remember, this is a man in his mid-20s. This is not a child anymore saying this. There are profound implications to the unity, the communion that is shared, that is brought into the world and into society by the Christian sexual vision. Now, the next reason why the Christian sexual vision would produce better outcomes is because of the fact that in the Christian version of reality, and when it comes to sexuality, there is an intentional focus on self-giving love. Now, if we go back prior to Christianity to the great Greek philosopher Aristotle, he rightly identified an important natural law truth about relationships. He said there's only ever three types of relationships that human beings can ever have. The first is what he called a relationship of utility. It only exists between two people because there's some utility that keeps them together. So think about a business arrangement. I'm a builder and you sell building products. Our relationship exists because we need each other to make money. But if you move into a different industry and you start selling beauty products, well, I have no need of that relationship anymore because I can't use building products to build houses. And so therefore, I'm not interested in your building products and you can't make money because I'm not interested in buying your beauty products. And so a relationship comes to a rather quick end. The next type of relationship is what he called a friendship of pleasure or a pleasurable friendship. And in a friendship of pleasure, it's a bit different. It's now about the fact that we enjoy, we take delight, we take pleasure from actually spending time together. But there's a third and higher form of relationship still, and it's what Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics identified as a friendship of virtue. And in a friendship of virtue, now things are completely different. It's no longer about utility. It's no longer simply about the feelings I experience. In a friendship of virtue, I now seek the good. I will the good. I desire the good. I act for the good of that other person. And Aristotle rightly identifies that this is not only the highest form of relationship that two human beings can share together, but in actual fact, for those of us who engage in the act of self-giving love, of seeking the good of another, we flourish and we become more fully and authentically human in that process as well, simply by giving of ourselves in this way. Now, why I'm telling you this is because in the Christian vision of reality, all relationships, not just marriage between men and women, but all relationships are a call to a friendship of virtue. In fact, we are called to model the ultimate example of a friendship of virtue, which is Christ, who sacrifices himself in total abandonment, total self-giving love on the cross. And every relationship is called to imitate that, big or small. We are supposed to receive other persons as a gift. The imago Dei, the image of God. We don't ever use them as objects because that would be to defile something that is truly sacred. An image of God is a sacred thing. So what do? You reverence it. You respect it. You treat it with the rightful dignity that it actually inherently has. And every other person is an imago Dei, which we receive as gift and we respect and we're called to. And of course, we see this play out very, very explicitly in the obligations that are expected when it comes to the spouses, the husband and the wife, in Christian marriages. St. Paul talks about this in Ephesians. Husbands must love their wives like Christ loved the church and died on a cross for her. So there's this total self-giving love that we are all called to. And in doing this, what happens? We flourish, and so does our husband or our wife. Of course, we know this. We know the absence of what this means. If you are honest about this, you know exactly the implications of the absence of the self-giving love. There's an awesome artist called Sarah Groves, and I think it's Sarah, it might be Sarah, it's spelled S-A-R-A, and she has this great song that I really, really love called Roll to the Middle, and it is about exactly this, what happens in a marriage when there is the absence of self-giving love. Let me read to you the lyrics. It's not a long song, but it is profoundly beautiful and important. We just had a World War III here in our kitchen. We both thought the meanest things, and then we both said them. We shot at each other till we lost ammunition. This is how I know our love. This is when I feel its power. Here, in the absence of it, this is my darkest hour. When both of us are hunkered down and waiting for the truce. All the complicated wars, they end pretty simple. Here, when the lights go down, we roll to the middle. No matter how my pride resists, no matter how this wall feels true, no matter how I can't be sure that you're gonna roll in too, no matter what, I'm going to reach for you. And obviously she's talking about a fight that's happened between this married couple and what happens? The absence of self-giving love. And the fact that we feel the burden and the pain of that absence tells us how profoundly important that self-giving love actually is and how real that self-giving love is in that marriage. If it was absent and we didn't notice, there would be a very, very serious problem. So the Christian sexual vision is one where couples, husbands and wives, are called to give of each other in total self-giving love. And so, of course, there is going to be a greater experience of happiness when couples, even in their own imperfect ways, are striving to do that. They're not always going to get it right. Christians are not perfect. But in their striving, they are absolutely building a better relationship experience for each other. Point number three as to why Christian marriages would manifest a better outcome when it comes to sexual intimacy and fulfillment. And that is the fact that sex is a bodily expression of self-giving love. When my wife and I got married, I wrote a song for her. And one of the verses is all about our wedding day. And it says this, standing at the altar, there were nerves and joyous rapture and beautiful you, a free and total gift of self, a life lived completely for the other. And the last line of that, a life lived completely for the other, I actually stole that from Pope John Paul II. One of his writings talks about marriage in this way. But this is the reality of what happens on the wedding day for a Christian couple. They get up and they make these permanent lifelong vows. They actually form a covenant with each other and with God, and it's just such a profound and truly sacred thing. And this covenant, this commitment, is not just about, oh, I promise not to leave you, or I promise to care for you. This is a total self-giving between two persons. And the sexual act that is participated in by that married couple every moment after that is a call and is a bodily reparticipation in those original vows that they made to each other. I will give myself totally, faithfully, and fully to you and to no one else. And so is it any wonder that when Christians approach their sexual intimacy in this way, they see it as something of a divine covenant or part of a divine covenant, a reparticipation in total bodily self-giving love, that there would actually be profound and wondrous fruits that come about as a result of people treating sexuality that way and not merely as a hedonistic, pleasure-seeking kind of experience? Here's how Louise Perry put it in her book, The Case Against the Sexual Revolution, A New Guide to Sex in the 21st Century. And remember, Louise Perry is not a Christian. We should treat our sexual partners with dignity. We should not regard other people as merely body parts to be enjoyed. We should aspire to love and mutuality in all of our sexual relationships. We should prioritize virtue over desire. We should not assume that any given feelings we discover in our hearts or our loins ought to be acted upon. This, in a nutshell, is an encapsulation of the Christian sexual vision, or certainly a very important aspect of it anyway, that we should treat the other as the imago Dei, as the image of God. We should aspire to love, and our love should be total and self-giving, and both husband and wife should be doing this. We should prioritize virtue over desire. And most importantly, we should not assume that any given feelings we discover in our hearts or our loins ought to be acted upon. Just because you have a desire for someone else, it doesn't mean that it is in your or their or your future or wider society's best interests for you just to act on that desire. Unfortunately, that's the great lie that I think has embedded itself in our culture. We've been told that somehow we are repressed if we don't follow our desires. We've been told that we are denying ourselves happiness. And why should we rob ourselves of happiness? And Christian sexual morality is about repression and about limiting freedom. In actual fact, the exact opposite is true. The Christian sexual vision is actually a call to self-surrender to that which is good and true. And in surrendering ourselves to that which is good and true, guess what? We flourish and we discover an even greater level of freedom. This is something I experienced in a very tangible way in my own life. I remember the night before I got married, I was called up the front. Well, all of us were, not just me, but all of us were called up the front to have a little practice for the next day's wedding ceremony. And I remember in that moment when we were called up the front by the priest to practice what would be happening the next day, I started to have a little freak out. And I all of a sudden realized the major gravity of what I was about to be entering into. I was about to take myself off the dating market. And I am sure that lots of ladies will have been absolutely distraught by such news reaching the outer regions of our great country. No, in actual fact, they probably weren't. But you know what it's like. You sort of think, oh my gosh, this is it. I'm making a commitment to this one woman for the rest of my life. Am I really ready to do this? Can I do this? And the fullness of the reality sort of hit me in quite a big and very unexpected kind of way. And I remember starting to feel a bit nervous. And I went home that night and I laid my head on the pillow and I remember saying to God, okay, God, if this is not your will, then you'll have to take me home in my sleep. And if I wake up tomorrow morning, then guess what? I'm going to that church and I'm going to get married because I'm going to assume that this is absolutely your will. And you know what? It really was. If I could go back in time and tap myself on the shoulder at that wedding practice, I would say, mate, just chill out. This is going to be one of the best and most liberating decisions you ever make. By committing yourself totally, faithfully, and fully to this one woman, you will discover a level of freedom and flourishing and growth as a man that you never, ever thought possible. I truly have experienced a level of liberation and freedom through this total commitment to just one woman for the rest of my life, and a degree of happiness that I never actually imagined to even be possible. I mean, we're all hoping. We go into these situations with great joy and anticipation. It wasn't like I was thinking it was going to be bad or anything, so please don't misunderstand me. But I didn't realize just how profoundly important this actually would be for me. Which brings me to my fourth and final point as to why Christian marriages would experience greater levels of sexual happiness and fulfillment. In the Christian sexual vision, sex is sacred. What you have is two imago Deis, a man and a woman, who are both individually the image of God. They come together and they make the imago Dei manifest in their loving sexual act. In the Christian vision of reality, God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit engaged in an eternal act of self-giving love that is fruitful. And that's exactly the power that is wielded within every marriage, where you have a husband and a wife who come together. It's a joyous bodily reenactment of our original sacred marriage vows. And then, of course, on top of that, we can be standing, if we're blessed enough, we can be standing in a hospital maternity ward 9 months later, holding that love in our arms and giving it a name. It is profoundly wondrous, the Christian vision for human sexuality. Far from being repressive and dark and fusty and sort of stuck in the past, this is a profoundly beautiful vision about what human sexuality means in the Christian vision of reality. Now, let's just be clear about this. This doesn't mean that Christians have some perfect heavenly sex every time. No, there are still all the usual struggles and bodily indifferences and challenges that are all part of this, and the kids won't go to bed on time, all that kind of stuff. It's messy. And not every sexual experience shared by a Christian couple is going to be the heights of sexual fulfillment and togetherness. But overall, and based on the foundation and the way in which that sexual self-giving, that bodily coming together takes place, that's the thing that makes the difference. This whole thing is grounded in, is surrounded by, is immersed in a truly sacred veil, a sense of the sacred, an immersion in the sacred. And in fact, if you think about today's current cultural situation, the only sexual norm, the only moral norm that you could probably say with any certainty is absolutely still held up as non-negotiable is the sexual norm of consent. So in other words, you must have sexual consent. So everything goes. Any sexual act with any number of people, that's all permissible as long as there is sexual consent between the parties. That's it. That's the only remaining sexual moral norm in our culture. But this raises a very important question. Why does sexual consent actually matter? Like, why is this particular form of bodily contact between two people, why does this require this special degree of consent? Why is it that there is this special veil that surrounds it and you must not treat it lightly? Why is that? Well, the only reason that sexual consent makes sense as a moral requirement, and it absolutely does, is because you first have to accept that the Christian vision of sexuality is true, that sex actually isn't just like any other bodily act. It is truly sacred. If I see you in an airport and you've got your AirPods in and you've just dropped your wallet, I don't need your consent to tap you on the elbow or perhaps to gently grab you by the shoulder and even turn you around and point you down at the spot on the floor where you've dropped your wallet. If you and I are in some sort of contact sport, like I'm playing a game of rugby, we don't all need to actually get consent from every other player before we start tackling each other. But we absolutely would do if there was sexual intimacy involved between two human beings. Why? Because sex is not actually just like any other type of bodily act. It is very different. It is a truly sacred thing. Here's how Louise Perry put it. She actually makes quite a pertinent statement about all of this when she says, if sex isn't worthy of its own moral category, then nor is sexual harassment or rape. And she's absolutely right. The reason these things have their own separate moral and very serious moral categories is precisely because of the nature of what human sexuality is and what human persons are. And that vision of reality didn't emerge from nowhere, and it certainly didn't come from the Enlightenment. It comes directly from the Christian vision of reality. The Christian vision of reality, which also boldly declares that you must never, ever use another person. You must love your neighbor as yourself. Never use another as an object. And that also declares that sex is a sacred bodily act. Now, just to wrap this all up, two things. First thing, two possible objections. And sometimes you get people who will push back and they'll say, okay, Brendan, you've just enunciated what sounds like a very beautiful vision, this Christian sexual ethic. But what about all those failed Christian marriages and those failed Christian relationships? Well, can I suggest to you that what you are seeing there is not actually a failure of the Christian sexual vision of reality. In actual fact, it's a failure to live out the Christian sexual vision of reality. It is a failure to love with total self-giving love. It is a failure to love like Christ, which is the call that all Christians are called to live out in their lives. And so failed Christian relationships and marriages, and there can be varied reasons for this. This is not about blaming particular parties. Like if you're in an abusive relationship, absolutely, you should not remain in a situation where you are being abused by another. But what you see there is you see a failure of the abuser to love like Christ. The Christian vision of reality doesn't say that's acceptable. The Christian vision of reality says that absolutely isn't evil. It's wrong. It should not be happening. The Christian sexual vision calls us to that which is good and true. And so failed Christian relationships and marriages represent a breakdown, not the actual normative and ordinary expectation or outcome of Christian marriage. In actual fact, the majority of Christian marriages where both parties, the husband and the wife, are doing their best to try and faithfully live out their Christianity, the majority of those marriages do not end up in those situations. And then the second objection that I often hear from people is they say, well, what about sexual compatibility? Because we are living in a culture now that tells us that you've got to quote unquote try before you buy in order to discover who you are truly sexually compatible with. But in actual fact, this is a completely false understanding about what sexual compatibility actually is. My wife and I are more sexually compatible now than what we were 20 years ago on the day that we got married. Why? Because we have been together longer. Our sexual compatibility was not something that was brought into our relationship by us. It is something that has grown through our mutual self-giving love and growing deeper in our understanding and our friendship together. That's what's actually given rise to greater sexual compatibility. It's not this magic secret sauce that suddenly you've got it or you haven't. Because you know what? Even the couple who start out with what they think is the most robust sexual compatibility, first of all, both of those spouses will go and grow through different changes in their life, and that will create challenges. And secondly, if they don't actually nurture that genuine love for each other, if they stop giving of each other with genuine self-giving love to the other, that sexual compatibility will collapse pretty quickly. So no, our culture doesn't have this right. Sexual compatibility is something that is born out from and as the fruit of total self-giving love for my husband or my wife. And when both of us strive to live this out, we discover greater compatibility. And with that in mind, let me share now my final point. And I wish I could show you this photograph, but I can't. But it's a photograph of me sitting in a hospital room over 17 years ago, holding my eldest daughter, Lucy, who had just been born in my arms. And yes, for those who are wondering and who haven't seen this photograph before, I do look very young and handsome and very fresh-faced. But for those who haven't and who can't see the photo, you just have to take my word for it. But this was a profound moment. I remember that moment still. I held my daughter in my arms and I just wept. I knew in that moment my life as a man had changed radically for the better and it would never be the same again. I can't explain to you just how profound that moment was. Now, every other one of my children arriving was a beautiful gift as well, but that first time was the moment when I really, in a very profound way, became a parent. It made sense to me in a very inescapable kind of way. And I could only experience that once, and that was when I held my eldest daughter. And all of the others, they're beautiful gifts, and they've added to that in different ways. But the first time that I experienced that was still the most profound. And I remember holding my daughter in my arms, and I spent quite a bit of time with her initially because my wife was still in recovery after an emergency C-section that was not expected. And so while she's recovering, I'm with my daughter for about 2 hours on my own. And I'm just contemplating all of this. And part of me is sort of freaking out a little bit, thinking, man, am I really going to be up to this? Am I going to be good enough as a dad? Do I actually know what I'm really supposed to be doing here? Guess what? I didn't know as much as I needed to back then. But that's another great thing about Christian marriage. We With two people side by side in total self-giving love, you actually learn and grow together through those challenges. But another thing that really struck me as quite important was how profoundly essential the commitment that my wife and I had made together to live out the Christian sexual vision of reality, like to save the gift of sex until we were married, just how important that decision really was, not just for us, but also for our children. Here I was holding my daughter and I wasn't freaking out and thinking, oh my gosh, how am I going to tell her parents about this? How are we going to explain this to people? All that kind of stuff. There were no worries about any of that kind of stuff. As I said, I had genuine concerns about whether I was up to the task of fatherhood, very healthy kinds of concerns. But what I didn't have was all of these other extra burdens that absolutely would have been brought into my life if I wasn't in a stable, loving Christian marriage with my wife when our daughter was born. And I realized for her as well just how important this actually would be going forward. She was born into the best possible foundation that she could be given in her life, and that would benefit her greatly as she grew into adulthood. And that's exactly what we've seen in the lives of our children. And trust me when I say we are not the most perfect parents. We struggle just like everyone else does. We have all those learning curves. But you know what's so fundamental on this journey is the fact that the two of us as Christians have agreed and committed that we will never ever walk away from this marriage. We will give of each other in total self-giving love and we'll figure out the challenges as we go. And that is a profoundly good and wondrous thing. So is it any wonder that the Christian sexual vision of reality really is the best for human flourishing? Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, live by goodness, truth, and beauty, not by lies. And I'll see you next time on The Dispatches. The Dispatches podcast is a production of Left Foot Media. If you enjoyed this show, then please help us to ensure that more of this great content keeps getting made by becoming a patron of our work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time on The Dispatches.